Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Get a load of you with the shaker. Holy cow.
Well, you know, I may not have my own branded glass, but I do have my cocktail shaker.
Well, yes. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. It's Friday. That shaking sound you hear, ice cubes in a cocktail shaker, is Kimberly Adams. It's Happy Hour Friday, as we like to call it, though, Economics on Tap.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I got you mid-pour.
Yes, you did, and now I've lost all of my screens. But yes, we have the live stream up and running as well. So for those of you watching on YouTube, thank you for joining us. And Kai, what are you drinking today?
I'm going on Old Standby. It's Elysian Brewery, the Space Dust IPA. It's good stuff. I will say here parenthetically a moment of personal privilege, if I might. Yesterday was my birthday, and my kids, some of whom are old enough to actually purchase alcohol, got me a bottle of Knob Creek. And so had we had ginger ale in the house, I'd have been having a bourbon and ginger right now. But we don't. Maybe next week. But I'm having a beer. You know, it's Friday.
Okay.
You? What are you doing? What'd you mix yourself?
So I attempted to make a drink that was recommended by one of the listeners, Rashid, who goes on Twitter as the barless bartender. Oh, sorry, the barless tender, because he's a bartender, but who's lost his job as a result of COVID. Yeah. So he's furloughed in L.A., but sent me this recipe for a tequila old fashioned. Which I'll drop into the chat in a minute, but I doubt I did it properly, but I made an attempt. It's got tequila. I didn't have simple syrup ready, so I just used a sugar cube, whiskey barrel bitters, orange bitters, and I also don't have an orange peel, so no garnish. But that is what I'm drinking, so.
I'm so lame cocktail-wise.
And it is tasty.
It's like, I'm sure it is. I'm like bourbon neat, or if I'm at a bar, maybe that's about it. Bourbon neat or beer. Anyway, should we do some news, shall we?
Yes, let's do some news. Yes.
Okay.
So I have a story from the 19th, which is a new news outlet that's very focused on the stories of and by women. They've been doing amazing work. You should really check
amazing
them out.
Work, truly.
But one of the stories they had in their newsletter today was about how Latinas had the highest unemployment rate this year of anyone, and that it's driving them to vote. And this is sort of that intersection that you and I often talk about of the economy and politics. Latinas are overrepresented in some of these groups that are the hardest hit by the job losses and the economic consequences of COVID, not to mention the fact that Latinos as well as African Americans are some of the hardest groups hit health-wise in the pandemic. And it's really pushing turnout. The reason this jumped out to me this morning, in addition to just being an amazing story, was because back in 2018 in the midterms, I was doing a story on voter turnout. And I went to talk to some folks at Unidos US, which used to be National Council of La Raza. And I asked them, you know, everybody keeps talking about how Latinos are key to the vote. Latinos are key to the vote. So were they getting more money from various groups to push Latino voter engagement and Latino turnout? And they're like, nope. Nobody's coming to us. But this year, I spoke to people at Voto Latino, a different group, and they said money was pouring in trying to do outreach to get more Latino voters to the polls. And so you have so many intersecting things here that are interesting in terms of the economy, in terms of COVID, in terms of the money pouring into this election and going towards targeting voters. So it's a fascinating article.
Yeah, and well, it is totally fascinating because obviously turnout this year is going to be A, everything as it always is, but also B, huge, which gets to one of my two things. And yes, I brought two because Molly does all the time. And
Molly, yes.
One of them is a thing called the U.S. Elections Project. And one of the things they're measuring is voter turnout already. That is to say, votes cast already because of mail-in or early voting provisions. And they've got a thing where they compare, and Tony's going to get this in the show notes, they compare total votes cast already in 2020 as a percent of 2016 total turnout, right? And so if you just mouse over a little bit, in South Dakota, we are already at 26 days before the election at 32.5% of total 2016 turnout, which is kind of remarkable. In Minnesota, which is turning into a battleground state, 21.5% of turnout. Wisconsin, 21.7% of turnout with a little bit more than 3 weeks to go. It's just really interesting to see how people are tuning into this election, taking advantage of early voting and getting the thing done before technical election day, which you have certainly talked about a lot on Marketplace, right? The idea that it ain't election day, it's election now, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what, 6 million people have already cast their ballots?
Yep.
And I was looking at this chart from a data analytics firm, Target Smart. They've been crunching sort of numbers on early voting as well. And if you look at the charts there, and I'll ask Tony to put them in the show notes, and see sort of how many ballots had been received and how many people had voted at this point in 2016 and 2018 versus now. Oh my gosh, it's astonishing. It's astonishing.
Yeah.
And I think
That's
will be fascinating. Which one?
This is Bonsai, the little black one. Sorry. She's just
barking.
Yeah. Hey, Bonsai.
Nothing wrong with that. We love
Bonsai. Come here. Come here. All right, she's coming.
Are you going to bring her and show her on the video?
Well, it'll be tough because I have to move
the
computer, and that's a little hairy. But all right, well,
I think you can.
Now,
all right,
now I have
to
do. I have to do. Come here. She doesn't like to be picked up.
I'll wait.
Boss, come here. Boss, come here. She also might pee on me for whatever that's worth.
Hi.
Oh,
hi, Bonsai.
I know.
My heart.
Oh, come on. Oh, come on.
All
right, down she goes.
Yes. We got the make me smile early.
Sorry, I interrupted you. And now I've got dog spit on my nose.
Wash it down with beer.
Yeah, I will, yes. What were you saying?
Okay, where were we? Yes. So, no, voter turnout. What will be really fascinating to me, and as these numbers are crunched and we look back on this later, how much of this is just people who would normally vote switching to mail-in balloting and getting it in earlier, and how much of it is new? And Tom Bonnier from Target Smart, who crunches his data, and he's mainly working with Democrats, I believe, was saying, if you look at the numbers, the early votes so far are a lot of 65 and older, or not 65 and older, but 50 to 65, that group that reliably turns out. But you are still seeing the numbers for younger voters tick up as well. And so, I mean, there's just going to be so much data about the country to look at when this is all said and done.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing, just to give a shout out to the show we did a number of weeks / months ago now, because I've lost track of time, the idea of the blue shift and how that's all going to work, which gets into my, you know, the idea that blue votes are the ones that come in typically after Election Day or later on, and that's the president will claim victory on election night, but the mail-in ballots and absentee ballots will be generally Democratic, which gets me to my second thing, which is a blog post from Twitter today about the steps they are taking ahead of the 2020 U.S. election. And it's a whole long blah, blah, blah thing. But one of the bullet items says, people on Twitter, including candidates for office, may not claim an election win before it is authoritatively called, to which I say, ha!
How?
Sorry.
Well,
yeah, just come
how,
on.
Also,
the idea that the president of the United States is not right. Come on. At like 6 o'clock Washington time, he's going to go, all right, it's over. I won. I mean, timestamp this. Truly.
So also, what does authoritative mean? You know, are we relying on the AP to call it? Are we relying on secretaries of state? But I posted something in Slack earlier about the rules in various states are different in terms of when they can start counting the mail-in ballots. And somebody made a point earlier on Twitter, and I'll find it, that if you look at the states that can start counting either the day before election or 3 days before the election or even on election day, by the end of the night on election night, a lot of those mail-in ballots will have been counted. And so we may actually have more information than we think. And it was a really interesting map and highlighting just those couple of states that say you can't start counting ballots until the polls close. And whether or not those states end up being swing states is what's going to be crucial.
Yeah, and obviously more information is better. So let me just read the rest of this to your point of who gets to decide what authoritative is. Here's what Twitter says, right? To determine the results of an election in the United States, we require either an announcement from the state election officials or a public projection from at least two authoritative national news outlets that make independent election calls. Tweets, here's the best part. Tweets which include premature claims will be labeled and direct people to our official U.S. election page. In other words, the president's going to claim it. We're going to put a little sticker on top that says, here's our official election page, and don't... sorry.
But what is...
You know what
But that's just not how people use social media, you know?
Yes, that is
Folks share without... Anyway. But, you know, go vote if you haven't already. Make a plan
to vote. For crying out
go
loud.
Go vote. Get... everybody in your space to vote, and even those who you may not know, just politely suggest without getting yourself into a fight.
Yeah. All right, hit that button there, Mr. Thorpe. I love it. I say it, he does it. It's amazing. If only that were like real life.
All of the power.
So okay, sorry. Let me just say here, let me break the fourth wall. So here's the deal. Our boss resigned a couple of months ago, and Marketplace needs a new big boss. And so I went out this week on Twitter, and I said, hey, Marketplace needs a new boss. If you're an inclusive, ambitious, nationally experienced, big thinker journalist, please let us know. And the number of people who wrote back to me and said, oh, my God, no, Kai, are you leaving? How can that possibly be? And the really funny part is that I'm not the boss. And nobody lets me be in charge of anything around here for really good reasons. Let's be clear, for really good reasons. I'm not the boss. Anyway, so all of which is to say, the only power I have is what I say into the microphone. So here's my make me smile item. I try really hard not to cross streams between here and Marketplace on the radio because I don't want to duplicate content because hopefully people deserve fresh stuff when they go to both places. But there was a study this week, actually it was about 3 weeks ago, in the journal Economic Letters.
All time is meaningless now.
I know, right? They actually did a study of the president's Twitter habits, and they did it to basically determine how much sleep he's getting. And here's what they discovered. He basically has been getting up and starting to tweet, right? They use tweets as a proxy for his sleep and awake hours. He starts tweeting, give or take, 6 o'clock in the morning Washington time, and has been doing that for 3 years. But what they discovered was that between 2017 and 2020, his number of late-night tweets, which they define as 11 p.m. to 2 a.m., has increased 317%. That is to say, more than tripled. And then what happens is, number one, the tweets that he sends late night get far less engagement. They're just not as dynamic and powerful for him as they think. But also, using some independent analysis of the tenor and text analysis of his speeches and interviews, the next day, the next day, after a late night tweet fest, he's way more angry than he is happy in his tweets and in his speeches and interviews, which makes sense, right? Because if you're up at 2 in the morning tweeting and then you get up at 6 in the morning to tweet some more, you've gotten 4 hours of sleep and of course you're cranky. Okay, so that's item number one. Item number two is they said the odds of his 2020 opponent gaining in probability of election after late night tweeting with the president go up while the president's remain unchanged. And I just kind of love that whole bleeping thing because we spend so much time thinking about his tweet threads. It's just
Amazing. Anyway,
I remember it. Very early in the Trump presidency, Arjuna, a former colleague of ours, and I, we did an analysis of Trump's tweets. Do you remember that? To see
how often
he was like talking about the stock market and the economy. And that was, I guess, when we still believed that there was going to be some moderation to it and it might actually, you know, tell us something about policy. And we spent time on this. And now we're just like, what is, what else? Okay. Yeah. My make me smile is about... Ah, this makes me so happy. So, Whoopi Goldberg says that she's working really hard to make Sister Act 3 happen, which is... okay, wait, let me stop for a second. Kai, have you seen Sister Act 1 or 2?
No, I saw Sister Act 1, loved it. Saw Sister Act 2, didn't much care for it. I'm a little fearful of Sister Act 3, I have to tell you.
No? It has to be wonderful. It has to. It has to. I need this.
Okay. It was amazing. I loved it.
Yes.
Can't wait for 3. Okay.
Great. Good. Smiling. Love it. Perfect. Someone on the chat says, there was a Sister Act 2? Yes, there was. It was great.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, wait. The never-ending Sister Act story.
I just saw that one from Mark Lush. Shut up. Let's move on. Nothing to see here. Move on, people. Move on.
I don't have to say a word.
Move on.
All right. That's it.
All right. Take us out. Go ahead.
Okay. That is it. So we will see you again Monday. Well, actually, I won't. Molly is going to be back next week.
Molly's
so
back.
In the meantime, send your questions and comments, preferably in the voice memo format so we can hear your melodious tones, to makemesmart@marketplace.org. There are instructions for how to do that in the show notes.
All right, hang on. I'm just waiting.
What you? So you're trying to run out the time so I don't have time to give
never-ending story. Look, we all know this end music is too long, right? Can I just say, we all know it's too long and we have to kill time at the end, so I'm just waiting. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner does digital stuff for us. Ben Hethcote produces video. Ethan Peretz actually does everything, so that's that. Eric Phillips does our newsletters. Also, the Make Me Smart skill on all those smart devices that you have that are always listening to you.
Always. Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner, who's going on family leave. That's the real Make Me Smile. And today's her last day. We're going to miss her. Donna Tam will be running the show while she is out. And the executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves, who got us all to put cats on our background screens for Bridget's going away party. Although you didn't because you were in the car, but
Bridget has a lot of cats, and she's also going to have, you know, one more baby really soon, which is cool.
Yes, babies are better than cats.
Hi, beloved intern Ethan Peretz here. On Thursday, October 15th, Make Me Smart celebrates its 300th episode. Now, don't tell Kai and Molly, but we want to surprise them with something special from you. We want to hear how we've made you smart in the past 300 episodes. So tell us something you've learned from Kai and Molly. Record your answer as a voice memo on your smartphone and send it to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. And as always, thank you for listening and supporting this show.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.